Hello, welcome to the podcast. Today I am so excited. We have Studio Cohab Firm. They're going to tell us about themselves and what they do and all about getting a co-housing community started. And please excuse, the dog is very excited in my background, so you might hear lots of clip, clip, clip of her nails that need to be clipped. Welcome.
Thank you. We're excited to be here.
So go ahead and tell us about yourselves, who you are, and about your firm a little.
Hi. So my name is Mathilde Bert. I'm an architectural designer from France. So yes, Studio Cohab is an architecture firm that specialized in community-oriented design, and particularly in co-housing. I studied architecture in France and discovered co-housing there, where the movement is a little bit less developed. And so I applied, you know, as soon as I graduated, after doing my final project from co-housing, I applied anywhere in the world where I could learn from people that know, you know, state-of-the-art co-housing, and ended up in Nevada City, California, with the co-housing company and with the, you know, people that knew how to do co-housing well, and learn from Chuck Durrett and Eric that I met there. Then it's been couple back and forth between France and the US, and we started Studio Cohab with Eric, I'd say 2 years ago, I don't know, something like that, a year and a half, 2 years ago. And we've been focusing on, you know, projects that are innovative and environmentally conscious, and you know, we really work collaboratively with our clients and the other partners of the design team. So, yeah, that's that for me.
Great.
Right on. Yeah. So as Mathilde said, you know, we met. You know, both of us kind of going to work for one of the original co-housing firms in the United States, kind of like learn how to do that. For me, kind of my interest in co-housing went a bit further back than that as well. You know, Mathilde was saying she was kind of exposed to co-housing in university. That's also where I learned about it, studying abroad in Denmark, and immediately just thought, you know, man, this is such an exciting place to live. You know, I need to live in one of these places by the time I have kids. You know, and was pretty excited about learning, you know, how to do that as an architect. A big part of my background as well is working at the Rocky Mountain Institute, which is a environmental, they call it a think and do tank. You know, kind of working on really, really cutting edge green building projects and developing new approaches to create sustainable communities and to do it cost effectively. So I think, you know, part of what Mathilde and I are trying to do with our firm is build on all of the, you know, the original ideas around co-housing as we think of it, you know, that originated in many ways in Denmark, you know, and then the practitioners who brought that idea to the United States, and then trying to kind of bring in to that history, you know, higher level of performance in terms of sustainability, as well as, you know, a higher level of kind of social inclusion and empowerment. So I think that kind of summarizes me and our firm, and we're just really excited to be here today on the podcast. Thank you for inviting us here.
Yes. Well, I'm so excited because, well, I didn't know about the Denmark connection. And for those who don't know, that's where co-housing basically started, where people learned about it. So it's like you went to the mothership. You went to the motherland when you saw it in Denmark. So if you could tell us briefly, what is co-housing and what it is not?
Yeah, we like keep looking at each other like, okay, you want to know that?
You're playing tag over there.
Well, I guess one thing that we've heard a couple of days ago that we kind of disagreed with is, I don't remember who said that co-housing is like a family, and we kind of disagree with that. It's not a family, it's, or, you know, like, we have a saying, I don't know if you have it in English too, but we say, like, we don't choose your family, but you choose your friends, and you definitely choose your community too. And so it's, you know, a group of people that decide to be conscient about living in a community, living with one another and being here to support one another. And that doesn't necessarily mean your best friend with every single of your neighbors. And that's kind of what I appreciate about the scale of co-housing in the US that, in my personal opinion, is a little bit lacking in France, is that people are unscared of scale it a little bit and be enough units, enough families to actually be, you know, an entire little neighborhood and a new little village that you built. And so, you know, the critical mass of people really helps doing that thing where you can have a common house. So yeah, there's so many different ways to explain what co-housing is.
I'll just interrupt a second for those who might not know, but the sweet spot with a co-housing community is usually, isn't it, like between 28 and 32 households, that has been what they found has worked the best. So it's not too small, it's not too big, where you actually know your neighbors, and it is individual units, and at least, you know, for everybody to have their own private house, and then a common house.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. And, you know, like, most numbers of, like, how many units exactly, you know, it's not a perfect science, obviously. It really depends on the design, actually, and on, you know, the individuals and the culture of the community. But, yeah, there is definitely, you know, somewhere around this number of units. And I guess, so, yeah, like, the design is really oriented towards the community. So you have, you know, like, kind of one of the major things that you will notice when you visit a co-housing project is that the car is, you know, like the housing is designed for the people and not for the cars. And it's kind of what's happening a lot of times now in our housing projects, you know, not in ours, but like in the housing projects in America. People can, like, the car is really putting all of the dimensions of the entire project. And so in co-housing, you park inside, and then you walk from your car to your house. And on the way from your car to your house, you cross the common house where you probably will have a neighbor that is hanging out and hollering at you and, you know, asking you to grab a beer with them on a Friday night or whatever. And then you cross, you know, you have spontaneous interactions with your neighbor because you cross them by walk on the way home, on the way to the common house. And it's a safe environment for kids, you know, if it's an intergenerational community, it's a safe environment for kids to play around because there's not this guy that is always with, you know, danger all around. And so, yeah, you have what brought me to co-housing first as an architecture student and then an architectural professional is the participatory process, too. So it's really, you know, having this idea about, like, as architects, we have tools to help the community design, but it's the community's, you know, like, they know what they need and we need to help them target that. And so we have a whole process, a whole series of workshops where from A to Z, we really guide the community to, like, help them figure out what they want the project to be like.
So instead of just saying, oh, I'd like to live in a house in that neighborhood, they are designing what will be in the neighborhood and making decisions about that financially and what works for everybody, and they get to know each other in the meantime while they're doing that.
Yeah, and I think, since, you know, we're kind of talking about, like, you know, what is co-housing, right? What is it not? You know, if you'd like to, if it's helpful, we've developed a couple diagrams of this that you're welcome to post with, you know, with the podcast, if that's helpful for the listeners. We're, you know, as architects, we like to communicate visually. Matilda's made these, what I think are really awesome illustrations to help explain this point. And I think there's two things that I think are helpful to contribute to the conversation in kind of defining language. So one is this idea of intentional community, which we think of as like an umbrella term that co-housing is one example of. And there are other types of intentional communities, like a kibbutz could be an example, or a convent, a fraternity. I would argue are all examples. An eco-village are all examples of types of intentional communities, ways that people are living together, not just because it's, you know, the cheapest or the best house apartment that they could find, but for a purpose beyond just only a place to live. Often the intention has something strong to do around community, like co-housing. Right, so that's, you know, kind of the first thing, co-housing versus this broader term of intentional community. And then there's this, and, you know, I think maybe this is partly of Mathilde's kind of like French background, but she described to me the other day, is like, I think we should call these the ingredients of co-housing. It's like a bolognese, right? Like it has certain ingredients that define what it is, right? Or like pizza, right? You've got like the crust, the sauce, and the, you know, and the cheese, right? And you can put different toppings on it, but without the crust, it's not really pizza. It might be delicious, but it's not pizza, right? So the kind of six ingredients of co-housing, you've just touched on a couple of them. You know, one of them is design for community. That's kind of those ideas around, you know, pedestrian-oriented landscapes and, you know, not having everything be driven by the car, for instance, right? So that's ingredient number one. Ingredient number two, you just touched on too, which is the participatory process, that the future residents play a big role in designing the community. The third ingredient is extensive common facilities. So that's usually like a common house, you know, places can be, you know, every community is different in terms of additional things that they have, but, you know, one defining part of co-housing is sharing common meals. And so without a functioning common kitchen and a common dining room, a place to eat those meals, we would argue it's, you know, it's not co-housing. It might be great, but not co-housing. The next ingredient is complete resident management. So, you know, the members of the community take care of keeping it going. It's not some big company. You know, there's some retirement communities, for instance, that there's a big company that kind of runs everything. That doesn't mean that the project's built by the residents, or, you know, they never hire a plumber or something like that, but they're the ones, you know, kind of calling the shots. The fifth ingredient is a non-hierarchical structure. So co-housing communities typically use some type of consensus or consent or unanimity, some way of making decisions where there's not one, you know, there's not a king or an oligarchy who's telling everyone else what to do, right? And then the last piece is that co-housing has separate income sources. So it's not a business. For instance, I've been a member of a worker co-op where it's a business that we're, you know, all owning together. That's different from co-housing, right? Co-housing is a place where, is a community where people live. And that doesn't mean, you know, a couple of people might not own a business together or something, but that's a separate entity from the co-housing community. So just kind of defining the terms, that's what we're talking about is co-housing today.
I love it.
That stoop of those different ingredients.
We'll mix them all together. So now you've pushed me technologically. I need to figure out how to post things for the podcast. But I'm also going to post a recipe for bolognese sauce, because now I'm curious what that is. Sounds delicious. But yes, and one thing about income is just like a condo or HOA, you are dealing with money, but it's not, you know, you don't share a business, like you said. It's just everyone pays into it, like dues, and you make decisions about it. But it's not your whole life. It's just a little bit and managing the property. So, great. Well, thank you. Now, one reason I wanted you all to talk, and soon, is because everyone can listen to this podcast forever and ever and ever. This is great information. But we do have one timed event, which is they are giving a class with the Foundation of Intentional Communities called, is it Jumpstart Your Co-Housing Project? Or what is the class called again? It's
I think it's creating a vibrant co-housing community.
All right. See, great title, creating a vibrant co-housing community, where they're going to teach a lot of this about how do you start your co-housing, what are the elements, just a lot of, well, you can tell us in a minute about the class, but one thing I like that you said in your preview of the class is that the first class will determine really the direction. You're not just going to go in with an agenda. You're going to hear what the students want, where they are, what do they know about co-housing, what benefits them, because lots of people are at different stages. One, curious, hey, what is co-housing? Two, I've got money. I've got a group. Let's go. So there's all sorts of levels. So tell us about the class that starts Tuesday, November
16. Yeah, we're really excited. We're hosted by the Foundation for Intentional Communities. They're the ones that are organizing. They're an incredible, nonprofit that has been really promoting, you know, as Eric said, like this big umbrella of intentional communities and helping us kind of promote the housing to it. And as you said, we feel like, you know, that's the beauty of your podcast too. There is quite a bit of content on like co-housing 101, and there's definitely a lot of work to be done on that too. You know, like every day when I talk with people about what I do, everyone thinks that they know what co-housing is, and they're like, oh yeah, I was in a co-op as a student. It's like, yeah, no, you don't know what it is, and it's fine. You know, like the one-on-one is still really necessary, but there is also people that are, you know, really educated about what it is and just want to be like, okay, how do I start it? And that's really kind of what we targeting our class to be. And obviously, if we need to go a little bit more into the basics, we'll be happy to do that too. But the idea is really to target for people that are like, all right, I know I'm excited. I know I'm a listener of this podcast already, you know, like I've been listening a lot about the housing, but I feel a little isolated because I don't know anyone that knows how to do it. And I don't know anyone that wants to kind of embark with me and, you know, like, how do I actually do it? And so we're hoping to create kind of a, you know, little network of people around the US because it is online. So that's, you know, the beauty of it too, is that, we want to, like have people from all over and help them getting ready. And so we'll talk a little bit about what is co-housing in a little bit deeper way than the 101, and then talk a little bit. I don't have exactly, and as you said, like, you know, we'll, the first course will really help us direct it, but we already obviously have a little idea that we want to talk about, and we're not just coming like, okay, tell us what you want. So we'll talk a bit about the design process, the development process, you know, the way you organize your community and consensus-based decisions. And, you know, we'll use multiple tools that we use during our workshops to kind of give a little taste about, like, what does it mean actually to use consensus in a group? What does it mean to, you know, have participatory process? And so, I don't have it under... I don't know if you're looking at it, Eric, about like the title of the classes. But
I think, you know, you can go to, it's www.ic.org, and then click on their link for online courses, and you'll see this course. It's at least on my screen, the first one to come up, like creating a vibrant co-housing community. And the learning outcomes are posted there. But I think, you know, Matilda did a great job of, you know, describing, right? It's, we're presuming that most of you wanting to take the class have, you know, a variety of level of experience, and are wanting to, you know, create a community, and are in some stage of that journey. And so, what we're wanting to do is kind of dive into all the different aspects from, you know, design to the organizational, how does the, you know, the project work, you know, money, making decisions, you know, the structure, you know, one of the things that in our introduction to the class we talked about is that, you know, I think one way to, you know, another way to think about co-housing could be that there's three pieces to it. There's the social piece to it, There's the physical piece to it, and then there's the organizational piece to it. And and that all obviously like starts with some person's idea, and then ultimately a group forms and the development process happens, and then it's a community that exists and evolves over time, right? But all three of those spheres, if you will, are really in play the whole life of a co-housing community. But I think one of our arguments or our approach is that what separates successful projects and successful communities from those that are less successful is the way that those three spheres intersect. So a physical environment that can really reinforce and support a vibrant social structure in the community, that really, helps. And that's why, you may have or may not have heard, but there's a number of professionals doing architecture and development consulting and things like that and co-housing, and certainly there's things that a group can only do for themselves, and there's a lot, it's not like people need to reinvent the wheel at this point, so there's a lot of things that you can just do pretty, it's a lot easier to create a co-housing community now than it was three decades ago, because there is so much institutional knowledge, right? So, that's one of the things that we bring to our clients as co-housing architects, is a deep understanding of the relationship of the physical environment and the social environment. So we're not just designing houses, in a common house and some parking, but we're figuring out, the relationships between those pieces. For instance, one example would be how the mail works. Is that, a couple post office boxes out by the road that, you can get your mail, but that's about it. Or, by incorporating that nearby or into the common house, it becomes a place where you bump into your neighbors. Recycling the junk mail you don't want becomes really easy. Maybe there's a message board where you find out about some great, hike that's happening this weekend. And then, someone, found your phone charger that you left in the common house and it's in your cubby. And so all of that happens, kind of effortlessly, as Matilde was saying, because of that, the physical environment that supports this much more robust social interaction. So, and that exists with all those, there's relationships between all three of those spheres like that. So, that's the kind of things that we'll be talking about in the course, is not just kind of like what it is and what needs to happen, but also kind of like what do we think are if we go back to the metaphor, stretching the metaphor of a recipe, it's like, it's not just what are the things in the recipe, but what are the kind of tips and tricks that help you, make your cream puffs really fluffy. Right?
Well, yes. We don't want the souffle that goes down when someone slams the door or whatever. Yes, exactly. There's tips. And I love how you said, because it's online, people are going to meet others across the country, or I'm sure other countries if they want to join. A lot of FIC classes, there's people from all over the world, depending on the time they can join. Because it is that same thing, not reinventing the wheel, learning from each other. And one thing I think about co-housing is a lot of times it really starts very local. However, people are interested. They will move, if they can, for their job or whatever the situation. You can get people from all over who will come and move there. And of course, now with technology, you can talk and still plan remotely. So I think that's a great idea that the students will get to meet each other, that you all have this information, and hopefully give them even more places. Like, yes, this, it's been in the U.S. now since the 1990s they've been built, so we have all this information, and Denmark even more from the 70s. So here are some things that'll help. Well, that's great. I like it. And that, so it sounds like an amazing class, and even just people who are still trying to figure out where they are and what they want to do, it'll give them some tools and connections.
Exactly. And something I wanted to add about that class is that, as you said, Eric, it's so much easier to start a community now than 30 years ago. It's also because technology has tremendously helped with distances. And so, as much as, people from around the world can now participate into a class in the US, I'll be casting from Kentucky, Eric is from Montana, and there's also this thing about time. And so we definitely want to be conscious about, not everyone can just, take 2 hours in the day on a Tuesday randomly during the day. And so we offer those classes to be, you know, they all will be recorded, and you can, if you can't watch it live, you can watch the recording, and we'll really try to foster, you know, a vibrant outside of class conversation, and try to make those people that can't participate live still part of that little community that we'll, you know, create with our class, and be able to ask questions and network and participate into the class in a different way.
That's great. Well, actually, I met Eric on a class, so I didn't connect until I saw you the other day. Like, I was in a class with him. When you're in the classes on Foundation for Intentional Communities, they have like a message board, so that's a way to connect, and I'm sure you guys can make your own. But also then you become alumni, and they have things where we can still connect. So yeah, I mean, I say take the class to everybody. go take it. Now, one thing I like that you said is in the class you are going to talk about the vision, because people think, okay, the vision is super important. Like, what do we want? Then that'll guide us on how we interact with each other and, you know, make decisions. You go back to, is this part of our vision? And of course, people can redo the vision. But also it's important for things like not like getting started, but marketing. Could you talk a little bit about that, how the vision also sets like how you really get started?
Yeah. I mean, I think definitely for the communities that I've been a part of, the intentional communities I've been a part of, as well as the groups that I've worked with. Yeah, I mean, it's like the North Star, really. And I think that, you know, on one level, you can look at the, you know, the vision statements of co-housing communities, and maybe you think, oh man, it's like pretty much the same thing. You know, like most of them say something about sustainability, you know, community, you know, and I think, yeah, like that's part of co-housing, right? And so, but for one, right, it's like if you're making a decision about some, you know, like, oh, okay, should we, like for instance, in my community, we've decided to internally subsidize to create some affordable housing. We're not legally required to do it, but it's a value of our community, and so we decided to do that. But you know, it does cost money, you know, and there's not, you know, like we're building housing for everyday people. So there are hard choices that need to be made between, you know, should we do that, for instance, or you know, have lumber in the project that comes 100% from sustainable forests. You know, like there are lots of things that align with our values, our personal values, that we might want to be part of the project. But in any, you know, any development project that's going to be, you know, accessible to everyday people, you're going to have to make some hard choices. So, you know, I think having that vision statement to come back to and be like, what is it that we came together initially around and are trying to achieve, you know, that helps, helps focus those decisions. You know, and at least my community uses a consensus-based process, and so every member has the right to veto a decision, but they can't just do it for whatever reason. They need to do it because they think, oh, this is going to be deeply damaging. This proposed decision is going to be deeply damaging, not to me, but to our community as a whole, right? And so the way that we define that is back to the vision statement. So if they can say, hey, you know, like, I feel like I can't support this decision because we've said part of our vision statement is, you know, we value sustainability and our lifestyles reflect that. And I think that's really undermining, you know, that, right? And then people will be like, okay, cool, I understand where you're coming from. I might not agree with it, but, you know, we are in this together, and that's what we're in here around, and that's a valid perspective. So I think that's, you know, kind of how, at least one way I think of how I and we use those. I think another story I like to tell about how vision statements are different. One project that that I worked on, you know, as the kind of as in my architecture role, is the Fair Oaks Eco Housing. It's in Sacramento, so kind of suburb of Sacramento, California. So it's, you know, like suburbia in California, that's maybe a lot of what, you know, the bing idea of suburbia comes up in someone's mind, you know, maybe that's kind of what you might think of. And, you know, it's California, right? It's like, tends to be hot. And so one of the big pieces of their identity, and this isn't so much their vision is around sustainability, but part of it was around being an intergenerational community. And so that goal of intergenerationality translated into wanting to swim and play in the water and having this swimming pool, which is right outside their common house. You know, and so that might be, you know, a kind of flavor of that community that, you know, reflects in some ways the local culture there, right? I live in Montana, just across the border, is British Columbia. Nelson co-housing is up there. And that's, you know, totally different culture than suburban Sacramento. You know, it's in the mountains, it's huge kind of forests and, you know, and a lot of kind of self-sufficiency and kind of connection with the land. And so, you know, they don't have a swimming pool all for climatic reasons as well, right? But in their common house, the basement, you know, is all about kind of food processing and preservation, freezers and, you know, sinks and, you know, things like that. Because, you know, harvesting, you know, growing their own food, harvesting, you know, from nature is a big part of that local culture. And so I think that's another way that this idea of, you know, maybe vision or kind of goals that are subset to that vision translate to different ways that this idea of co-housing might get implemented by different people based on their personal culture and the community culture that they create together for their co-housing.
Great. And I also like, yeah. With the hold on, I'll get you if you say anything. I don't want to get save your thought a sec. You mentioned like for intergenerational that people need to be careful with their marketing. Are they only marketing to people with young children? And then how do you make sure, you know, the voice you're putting out information where retired people would be or people with grown children? And same with diversity, maybe not just advertise at the farmer's market, which tends to be more one race or class, and, you know, just have diversity even in your marketing and really look at your vision. So I just wanted to say what you had said earlier. So I want to basically copy what you said the other night and put it here. Okay, what were you going to say?
And that's where I was going to.
Oh, okay. Sorry.
Like-minded. It's okay. Yeah, kind of talking about, you know, like the correlation between vision statement and marketing. Eric's community is Bozeman Co-housing, and, you know, their goal from day one was we want to be net zero energy. So it means that all of the energy that you spend is energy that you produce on site. And that's actually kind of a big goal. And especially, as you said, like for everyday people, you know, like market rate housing and sometimes a little bit below market rate, that's actually really ambitious. And kind of like looking back at the marketing process, they're not sold out. They've been sold out for a little while now, and they're about to break ground, and they didn't really use the marketing budget because this goal was so innovative and so attractive to people that some people joined the community, you know, primarily because it's a net zero project and because, you know, like the cost of the solar panels might actually be the same budget than the marketing budget that they didn't use, you know? So like, it kind of like, when you're really clear about what you want, where you want to go, people instantly understand it and will want to follow. And it's so attractive that you don't have to wriggle around and try to like grab everyone because, you know, like it's clear where you're going. And if I want to work with you, I'll work with you because I know exactly how you're doing it. And so, yeah, like, another project we're working on right now, there's a group in Louisville, Kentucky, in Louisville, depending where you're from.
I've heard it as Louisville, but maybe it is different.
Louisville. They're, you know, really wanting to be really focused on diversity. Some of the leaders, or like some of the core members of the project, members of a nonprofit that's called Matching the Age that works with adults with disabilities. And so, you know, from the core of the day one of this project, it's been all about, we want to be diverse to people with diversities of abilities, and also we recognize that we're in a really in a city that was really hurt by redlining and is still suffering from it, and it's a really segregated city, and so we want to, you know that, acknowledge it, and do everything we can to be a racially diverse and an economic background diverse community. And so that's, you know, you don't market those two goals, those two vision statements the same at all. And yeah, like, as you could, like, go to the farmers market for net zero energy projects, for the one about diversity, you might want to revise a little bit how you're going to market it and who you're going to try to attract to your project. So yeah, it's fundamental. And again, yeah, like, even though a lot of them look the same, we actually, like, we're planning on during our class having a little exercise where, you know, we have, and that's you know, from a book of Sherry Leach, you know, it's not our activity, but having an activity where you have different vision statements and different dilemmas, and you're trying to solve your dilemma based on your vision statement. And that's really like how communities operate, you know, on an everyday basis. It's really like every problem has a solution that is hiding in the vision statement, if the vision statement has been carefully drafted. So.
Right. And and like you said, sometimes people have very bland ones, but that's why it's important to try. And you can change later, you know, when you, yeah, when all the kids grow up, you might be a very different place. You're like, oh, wait, we need to, how do we get little kids again? Everyone loves living here so much, but they've all grown up. So things change. I know one thing you mentioned is something, I don't know if you do this for your clients or if you'll talk about in the class, of a sustainability audit, where when they're building, you can look at and compare the costs of their decisions and the environment. Could you talk a little bit about what that is? It sounds amazing.
Yeah, totally. I mean, I can talk about it some. If you Google me, I think you can find a paper that I co-authored on the topic. About a software called Green Footstep. Not the only person who's ever worked on this. Definitely, I'm not trying to say that. But I guess I am saying it's a little bit of a deep topic and a little techie. But I think, you know, the kind of the top line kind of idea about this, right, is that you know, kind of going tying in what we were talking about before, of this idea of kind of the Bozeman project that we're working on, their goal of net zero energy. I think, you know, as we're recording this, the COP conference is wrapping up. And I think there's a lot of global awareness around the kind of ambitious targets that are necessary to adequately address climate change, as well as, I think, at least I've heard a lot of reporting about, you know, as the beneficiaries of a lot of that carbon that's now in the atmosphere, being people living in developed countries, perhaps an increased responsibility that we have to address that kind of privilege that we all benefit from. Of you know, a lot of countries didn't benefit from the Industrial Revolution in the same way we have, and so you know, I don't think that you know, net zero energy is, you know, or net zero carbon for one project is certainly not going to solve the whole thing. And yeah, I mean, even that project, you know, by 2040, 2050 should be doing better than that, right? But I think that's, you know, like, in my opinion, I think every co-housing project that's built today should be doing that. And, you know, I just ran some numbers while Matilda was talking. She was saying, oh, maybe it's about the similar cost to a marketing budget. And based on my rough you know, calculations, it is. I mean, I think the project's spending about 4% of the home prices on solar panels. So, you know, it's not this huge additional cost. There certainly is some investments in, you know, energy efficiency in the building as well, too, which have a lot of other advantages in terms of, you know, acoustic separation and thermal comfort and, you know, light and air and things like that. But, you know, we're not talking about adding, you know, hundreds of thousands or many tens of thousands of dollars to a home. But part of, you know, I think, you know, this kind of audit thing, that's definitely something that we brought into our practice from, you know, my background at Rocky Mountain Institute, which is all about trying to figure out the most cost-effective way, not just trying to be green, but how can we make this be, you know, a profitable, smart business decision as well. And certainly, you know, I'd say the biggest part of it being a smart business decision is leveraging the value, not just the cost, as Mathilde was talking about. Bozeman did a great job of, you know, selling out quickly and using that, the value of their sustainability commitment to have really effective marketing and save money on their marketing budget that way. So maybe it didn't cost them anything in the end, right? But in terms of, you know, our role of kind of balancing all the different ideas, we use a software where we can apples to apples compare the amount of energy that would be saved by more insulation to the cost of generating that same energy with solar panels, and compare, you know, the software crunches thousands and thousands of modeling runs to tell us exactly, yeah, you should use this much insulation, these windows, et cetera. And that's going to be the most cost effective way to hit that goal of net zero energy. And I think that's, yeah, pretty unique thing that we offer to our clients, especially for, you know, it's the kind of thing that usually is only done on like really large projects, not housing projects. So I'm really excited to do that.
Oh, well, I mean, it was all new to me what you said, but it sounded great. Like, here's how much it costs, and this is what it does for the environment. And that's part of co-housing when you're developing, you're making all these decisions and what works best for the community. So sometimes, like, oh, we would all want that, but whoa, that's going to up our cost of the project. And if that's something you could also talk about is some of those design choices. And I guess, I mean, you mentioned scale. Is that like making, like one thing that's, when you move into co-housing, you can have a house that's your house. You're the first person to live there. But it's not like building your own house and you can have this amazing kitchen with all these different details, because you want everyone to have their house, hopefully at a similar price or, you know, whatever price. Well, anyway, you can talk about more about how, if you do a certain type, it makes it faster and more affordable. It is different than just building your house out there in the woods somewhere. If you could talk about that, how those decisions and how it affects everybody.
Yeah, totally. So kind of, you know, yesterday when we were talking about that together, what I said is that I feel like, especially in France, but it happens in the US too, people sometimes get confused between participatory design and custom housing or like custom design. And that's really different. It's not because you participate into the design of your community that, you know, your kitchen will look exactly like your grandma's kitchen because you have great memory there and like no one likes it, but like it's yours and so on. And you totally can do that. So like the way we proceed, so you need some standardization to make it, you know, affordable. If every single house, if you have a 30 units project and every unit is different, it's a nightmare to build and it will be extremely expensive. And so you need some type of standardization. Usually it's by unit types. Sometimes, you know, you have, for example, in Bozeman, we have, I think, three types of 2 bedrooms, 1 bathroom unit. Usually, you know, it's like one type of unit per number of bathrooms and bedrooms. And anyways, you try to decide as a community. We have a whole workshop to design the private units with the community where they agree on one basis of design. And then you can always have options to kind of upgrade some of the materials or, you know, like add whatever you want. It depends on the community. But then like the third way to look at it is you can always customize your house once you moved in or, you know, like once it's built. That really helps the process. And, you know, we guide the communities to have, you know, the fewer sort of portions and that we both worked on together when we worked in California. Portenzen has, it's a senior co-housing project. So, you know, the needs for 3 bedrooms units are pretty low in senior co-housing projects. And so they only have 2 types of units. And that really helps getting the price down. another thing that we've been noticing too, is especially with Rodman co-housing, is that people that are wanting to buy a three bedroom unit are usually coming with more sets. And so, you know, like those units are way more expensive than a, you know, studio apartment or one bedroom unit. And so bringing different level or like different types of incomes into the project really helps kind of finding this fine tuning into balancing out all of those prices and finding something that works for everyone and having, you know, a more diversely, you know, rich, I'm losing my words, than like having, you know, like people with different economical backgrounds into the same project. Because at the end of the day, you know, for example, the price of the common house just fitted into the number of people that are in the community. So if someone is coming, you know, with more money and someone is coming with less money, you'll be able to, you know, afford the same things for less money. And I explained that pretty well. But
no, I like it that it's not all, like it's a bit of standardization with some of the choices in the houses. But yes, there'll be a three bedroom and a studio. There'll be diversity there. And like you said, people can always remodel and add things or not. I mean, you know, it's mostly just whatever's on the outside that the whole community needs to decide on, or whatever laws or whatever's going on in the area. But inside the house, it's everybody's personal house. And I figure, don't kitchens need to be remodeled every 10 years if you want to be hip or whatever anyways? I don't know what the rate goes, but usually people need to remodel at some point or want to. So you can always add more of those touches, but
exactly. And you have, you know, we have a whole system, so we like to work with developers that are, you know, like really knowledgeable in co-housing too. And so, for example, on Bozeman co-housing, we work with co-housing solutions with Katie McCammon, and she has a whole way of, you know, formulating and calculating the premiums. And so, for example, for those two bedrooms, it, depending on if you're in the middle units, so like you're sandwiched basically in between two units, so you have lights and windows only on two facades, instead of if you're end units of the building, so you have lights and windows on three facades, you know, it's more attractive, and so it's more expensive. And so depending if you're on the first floor, on the second floor, you'll have a balcony, or you'll have a whole backyard, you know, depending if you have the beautiful view on this amazing mountain range that they have there or not, you know, like all of those prices are calculated and fine-tuned to really reflect the market and, you know, like what people desire, and that really helps to like having some way more, so like I think there's something about like the sandwiched unit, the interior units is something like 25% less expensive than a unit that will have a beautiful view and a backyard, and you know, it has the same, it's about as big and has the same number of bedrooms and bathroom, but it has all of those little, you know, bonuses, so you know, like amenities that the other one doesn't have. And so it allows, you know, different families to join the project.
Very nice. So I have some follow-up. I want to make sure everybody gets at the end some of the information you talked about. But is there something else you wanted to add that I forgot to ask? Or I was looking over my checklist, but anything before we wrap up?
I don't know. I had two random thoughts I'll throw in here. One, I think we didn't really dive into affordability much in this conversation, but I know that's a really important topic. And, you know, I think we touched on a couple things, right? That there's definitely, you know, the level of customization and the level of affordability are in direct tension with one another, you know? So, but there are other ways to create affordability besides just standardization. That's one of many strategies, you know, and I think that, but, you know, that's maybe another conversation for another day. Definitely something we'll talk about in depth in our course. But yeah, I mean, I think another thing, I think a big idea that I would throw out there for folks who are forming communities is that, at least in our experience and those of you know, the folks that we regularly collaborate with, you know, there's no silver bullet. You know, if there was some magical way to make housing, you know, for half the price as everyone's doing it, people would be doing that. So there are, but that doesn't mean there's nothing to be done. It just means that there's a lot of strategies and a lot of them, you know, have just like customization, right? Like customization is great too, right? So it's choices to prioritize. You know, another example would be land, right? Like the cheaper the land, the more affordable the project is going to be. But also, you know, the cheapest land is usually way on the outskirts of town where the residents are going to be spending more money on transportation, having a bigger environmental footprint as a result. So, you know, there's like a little bit of a tension there, both. So anyway, there's, you know, a dozen more things like that that factor into making a project affordable or not, for all the members, or as Matilda was just talking about, creating diversity within the community so there are both affordable homes and you know, more expensive homes. And I think that's one thing that's really exciting about co-housing is that, you know, there's a pretty ugly history of zoning regulation in the United States. You know, a lot of times it's been used in some cases very intentionally to perpetuate systems of racial and socioeconomic segregation. I'm really excited to be part of a movement that's bucking that trend and trying to work to get people of, co-housing communities are almost always dramatically more socioeconomically diverse than the neighborhoods in which they're sitting. I think that's, you know, part of, you know, what we need to be doing in this country where so much of what you read on the news is about how separated and kind of divisive the country is right now. So, you know, I think the more that we can learn to work with and live with people who are not as similar to ourselves, the better we're going to be as individuals and as a country. So, and I think I just wanted to segue that idea back into another piece of this kind of story of co-housing starting in Denmark, which I think is valid. It's a history. You know, I think of, you know, rather than thinking of the history, I think if we think of history as having multiple ways of telling it, I think there's there's advantages to that history. I think that history is also, you know, when we say, oh, co-housing started in Denmark, you know, this, our neighborhoods are so car-centered, you know, everyone lives in suburbia and, you know, they have no social relationships. And so therefore co-housing started. I would argue that that's like pretty situated in the white middle-class experience of what America is. And, you know, for instance, you know, there's been, a history of African American cooperatives that stretches back to the 1700s in this country. And I think if we, as a co-housing community, you know, a co-housing movement can start thinking about, you know, there's lots of people who are living together in community and cooperating before and since and parallel to when people started doing that in Denmark. And I think the more that we can kind of bring those into these conversations and the way that we're thinking about co-housing, I think that will really help us, you know, understand the needs, not, you know, maybe, you know, what's the needs of someone who, like, I went to school in St. Louis and lived in several neighborhoods close to the center of St. Louis. And they were totally different than what I thought they were before I moved there, right? And so kind of understanding some of, you know, like what is the experience of, you know, living a mile from downtown in St. Louis and having the community be so disinvested that there are blocks that are completely grass because all the buildings are gone. The needs of a person living in a community like that are pretty different from the needs of someone living in suburbia, right? And so if we're really going to build inclusive communities, I think we need to think about, what has organizing around cooperation and solidarity looked like in more diverse segments of this country? And as Matilda said, that's part of, you know, we're trying to operationalize in our work with the group in Louisville. So just wanted to bring that piece in.
Well, thank you. Yeah, that's one reason I didn't touch affordability. I'm like, well, that's a whole, that's a big conversation. But I'm so glad you will be talking about it in your class. And we'll do shows on it. But yeah, there's a lot there. So what I want to make sure everyone knows is, so Eric, how do they Google you and get this paper you wrote? and the information you talked about.
Can you ask the next question? I'll look that up and get back
there
to
we
it.
Go. Very good. Very good. But he is Eric Bennett. I'll say that for one. And then same thing with the diagrams. Is that on your website, on Studio Cohab website?
Not yet, but yeah, I can definitely add it to our website. And yeah, that's kind of what I wanted to add to. If you listen to this podcast and are interested into joining the class and can for any reason, we would love to hear why, because, you know, it's definitely a work in progress and we want to make it as accessible. You know, we're professionals, we also advocates, and we truly believe into this movement. And so, you know, whatever we can do to help people learn more about co-housing and, you know, get started with creating their own ones, we're happy to help. And yeah, if it's too late to, like, if you listen to this podcast in a year or whatever, same thing, reach out to us, go on studiocohab.com. We have a contact us little thing, and you can send us an email directly. And so yeah, we'd love to hear any thoughts, any, you know, like challenging thought from what we said today, anything, you know, like we want to keep we can talk about co-housing forever. That's kind of the problem of this episode. I feel like it's gonna be a little long. and so yeah, like we would love to continue the conversation with anyone that is interested in it.
Wonderful. Well, if you send me those diagrams, like I said, I'll take on the challenge of learning that part. And I know other podcasters, so they can walk me through it. So studiocohab.com. And I think you have like a subscription or something, because I know I get things, bing. So, or I got the email about the class. So everyone should
get on the list. Yeah, we started like an emailing list.
That's
we don't really have like a newsletter yet. It's just the two of us. So, you know.
Well, I got your email. So you get emails about the classes. And if you can't make this class, like if you hear this too late, keep checking back. There might, hopefully there'll be future classes, and talk to Studio Cohab.com about if you can't afford it. They want to try to make it as affordable as possible. I know Foundation of Intentional Community usually has some sort of scholarship or pay what you will on a lot of their classes also. And then you mentioned a book. Oh, I wrote it down. Now I can't read my handwriting. You said when you do the activity, it's a book from somebody. So I'll have to...
Yeah, Sherry Leash. And we can, you know, like we're... Our approach to design, to collaboration is really like we want to be like as collaborative as possible and cover a ton of literature around co-housing, around intentional communities that we'll recommend in our class, and that I'm happy to send you different links, and you know, you can add that to your podcast too. There's so much great material by so many great people that you know, like really help dig into it a little bit deeper. So yeah.
Right, and that sounds like something architects and designers and developers, it's something, a resource for them also. So that's nice. You've given me a new word that I'm apparently a co-housing nerd. So, you know, I try to read all these things and look at all these things. So there's lots out there. So let's get the information to those who want to be nerds too.
Yeah, I call myself a nerd, and then you said you were
now
one.
Now I'm one too. I've joined the co-housing nerd gang. I was like, that's me. Oh, that makes sense. Well, thank you both so much. So you'd look up Eric Ben. Oh wait, I'm sorry. Is it Bonnet? Bonnet. Bonnett. And we can learn about like the audit of sustainability, and studiocohab.com is where you can find them and get information, and they want to hear from you, so that's great. And then also Foundation of Intentional Communities, or four, but it's FIC.com, I believe, and they have lots of classes, and some are free, and like I went to your all's presentation. What was that?
The FIC, the Foundation for Intentional Community, their website is www.ic.org.
Oh, it's ic.org. But if you put in FIC, that comes up.
You'll
so
find it
is for me. But yeah, so Foundation, Intentional Communities, but if you write FIC and IC, then, or just, we'll you'll find things. And always, you can always reach out to me. Well, thank you both so much.